The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Professor Sir John Strang, M.D., is a clinical academic and one of the world's leading addictions researchers. He was principal investigator in the randomized injectable opiate treatment trial in the U.K., which compared the safety, efficacy, and cost-effectiveness of prescribing injectable diacetylmorphine, which is medicinal heroin, versus oral methadone for people addicted to heroin who failed to benefit from standard treatment. Sir John was one of the keynote speakers at the 2024 National Drug and Alcohol Research Center's annual research symposium, which was held recently online and in person at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Before any more ado can possibly be furthered, here is Professor Sir John Strang, MD.
So I wanted to take us to a different type of science. So we've heard about data linkage from Louisa, and it's important to bring the most powerful bits of science we can to the fields that's of concern to us. This is a different type of science to do with looking at randomized trials, but also particularly looking at how do we get lasting impact. I'm in a competition to see how many slides I can get into 20 minutes. Lots of declarations. I'm a clinician as well as an academic, and I'm interested in the policy process. And I've worked with governments and industry, and was involved with this particular trial. So these slides will be there, so you can look at them in detail. And Louisa, I too can't see a damn thing down there, but but I think I know the slides okay. Various credits, and I say with apologies to my colleagues that they don't get individual name checks. People can look through it or look through the papers if they're wanting to see it. But it involves extensive collaborations from people from different types of organizations to be able to get a trial like this off the ground. So I'm going to take us quickly through five different stages about the heroin trial that we had in the UK. And you've had an interesting history about the debate of heroin prescribing or hydromorphone prescribing here in Australia as well. So let's just look at the history around heroin and heroin prescribing. Just for anyone who didn't know about it, heroin is what was a branded pharmaceutical product. You know, we've had heroin as a medication in the UK for more than a century. The US also had heroin as a prescription medicine. I've visited colleagues and done talks in the US where they go, no, we've never had it as a prescription. So you have to sort of show them the fact that at this time you could contact your drug rep in New York to obtain a supply. So in the UK, there was a famous Rolston report in the 1920s, which established the legitimacy and the authority of medical prescribing in the name of various forms of treatment, but including the treatment of addiction. And the word maintenance wasn't used then, but essentially this was an endorsement of the fact that if efforts to withdraw somebody from treatment persistently failed, then an ongoing prescribing approach was legitimate medical practice, separate in particular from US policy at that time and subsequently. All was pretty quiet in the UK around the opiate addiction problem or the heroin addiction problem up until the 60s, when as part of what happened in sort of many parts of the world, part of the youth revolution included the spread of wider involvement with drug use, and in particular in London, but also in some other cities in the UK, there was a socially transmissible increase in involvement with heroin use. And for the first time ever, people in their 20s or even in their teens were being seen involved with heroin use. And initially, the new clinics that were set up took over the role of prescribing injectable heroin as part of treatment. But progressively, there was a sort of disillusionment that crept in that this unmonitored liberal prescribing of heroin wasn't addressing the problem, was creating a secondary black market. And so over the next few decades, we saw a withering of injectable heroin prescribing, not because the law prohibited it, but because the medical profession and the addiction treatment field just concluded it wasn't an appropriate way of managing the situation. And that took us up to a time when it was almost becoming just a historical quirk that had happened, when the Swiss then took the approach and reconceptualized heroin prescribing. And Ambrose Lichtenhagen, who sadly died last year, was very much the architect of taking a sort of rusty old concept that the British system had and reconceptualizing it as supervised heroin prescribing, which is what was introduced in Switzerland, subsequently studied extensively observationally. Most of it was observational in Switzerland, but also with a very influential randomized trial from Wim van den Brink in the Netherlands, looking at whether you could engage people who were otherwise failing to derive any benefit from their treatment and actually achieve more engagement and more gains than you were otherwise achieving with that challenging treatment-resistant population. About that time, at the beginning of the century, so just over about 20 years ago, the UK government picked up on this, and in their drug strategy, they identified that heroin should be available on prescription to all those who have a clinical need for it, which is a really powerful statement, although it doesn't actually define how do you work out whether somebody has a clinical need for it. But they also described how it should be provided, that it should be in safe places with careful supervision and monitoring, and attention to prevent seepage into the wider community. So it was a treatment for an entrenched population of people with heroin problems who'd repeatedly failed to derive any benefit from more orthodox treatments. And so the clinics would need to be open 7 days a week, 365 days per year. It was an exciting time, but also quite a challenging time. I remember the meeting talking with staff about how excited I was that we had a new clinic, and there was a general sense of excitement. And then I got to the point that this means we'd be open 7 days a week, and they would also cover Christmas and the New Year. And couldn't quite understand why the level of enthusiasm sort of went down a little bit. Anyway, this was a completely new concept in the UK, and we really wanted to know, would it work in the UK context? We'd seen the Swiss observational work and the Dutch randomized trial, and we set up a randomized trial in the UK. We had a young visitor from Australia who was working with us at the time, and so, you know, and Nick Linseris was working with us, and very much helped and drove defining the method we were going to use. These slides are available, so if anybody wants to see the detail, they can look it up or ask for copies of it. A few quick photos. It's actually not very photogenic. Essentially, we have rooms and we have tables and chairs and things like that, so it doesn't make for good photographs. But anyway, the clinic is sort of pretty unremarkable. Somebody's medication would be prepared in advance. It's a high threshold program, so you've assessed somebody, you know what dose is their ordinary dose to be taking, either twice or three times per day. We would sometimes be asked by people, you know, do we go down the street to buy the heroin? And you have to explain, no, it's a pharmaceutical drug, it comes from the pharmacy like any other medication. The patient would be called in. medication would have been prepared, and they would self-administer the drug within the clinic. Most of the photo shots are of colleagues from Australia's had a remarkably high contribution to the work we've done in this area. So when Nick and Sheriff moved back to the back to Australia, Deborah Zader took over as a consultant, leading on the clinical activity. We're also fairly committed to doing observational research, trying to look at the nature of what we were providing and how did we make decisions about policy and practice. And this was a paper, for example, about whether we would or would not permit a groin injecting into the femoral vein, which was quite a common practice in the UK at the time. And was this something we should permit or shouldn't permit? And we then had the main results from the trial, and I'll very quickly take you through those. If you want to see the published version, then here's the Lancet paper. And it we took just over 120 people. By and large, were defined as people who were causing grief and headache to one's colleagues. And Michael, I think, is that a fair description of what the entry criteria are? That, you know, that colleagues would be saying, we've repeatedly been trying with Joe or whoever, and we can't get anywhere. If you think you're so clever with this new supervised heroin clinic, well, you have a go with Joe. And they would be randomized into either having optimized oral methadone, where we'd pay attention to making sure the dose was right, looking as far as we could at getting better adherence, against the supervised heroin clinic treatment. And in the UK, we had a lot of prescribing of injectable methadone. You actually have a small history of injectable methadone prescribing here in Australia, but it's never really, I think outside the UK, it never became a widespread practice. And so we had a third condition with supervised injectable methadone. And we were wanting to look at, we had lots of arguments about what the primary outcome should be. And we decided that if there wasn't, whatever other gains there might be, if there wasn't a reduction in somebody's street heroin use, then it was actually not causally linked to the actual treatment being provided. And so we were looking for street heroin use. And to begin with, we said it would completely disappear. And then we said, well, actually, we want to be able to capture it if there's been a major improvement that's less than complete abstinence from street heroin. So we were looking for a reduction to less than 50% of the random urine samples that were taken, less than 50, that on most occasions when a test was done, it would be negative for street heroin use.
We're listening to a keynote address by Professor Sir John Strang, MD, which he made at the 2024 National Drug and Alcohol Research Center's Annual Research Symposium. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's get back to Professor Sir John Strang.
And for those of you who are sort of nodding off and want to know, well, what did we find? Here were the sort of four take-home messages, which was the biggest quitting or the biggest reductions in street heroin use were in the group to whom the supervised heroin treatment was being provided. Supervised injectable methadone actually did disappointingly. It wasn't as close to supervised heroin as we'd hoped it would be. But it was still better than the optimized oral methadone group. What was interesting is that the group who was supposedly repeatedly failing in methadone treatment, when we optimized it, we saw improvements with some of those people, but nothing like as much as with other groups, but also the speed with which that change occurred. So I'll come back to that in a couple of slides. These are the data from the Lancet paper. But I'm going to skip over these and show them to you in a different way. So if we take these three groups, so these are randomly assigned people, and at the beginning of treatment, how many are not responding? You know, how many are still having sort of heroin, street heroin use every day and are non-responders from our point of view? Now, they haven't started treatment yet, so 100% of them are not responding, which is a relief, because since that's the reason that they're in the trial, it means we selected our patients appropriately. So when we looked at 6 months at how have the different groups performed in terms of whether they've now giving 50% clean urines, so clean is not the product, 50% negative street heroin samples, you can see here that the supervised heroin group, you've got nearly three quarters of them who are for most of the time giving specimens that are negative for heroin use. Your methadone group, there's a quarter of those who've made those improvements, and the supervised injectable methadone group's only slightly better than the oral methadone group. But we wanted to go a bit further than that because people said, well, have they completely quit street heroin use? So we actually thought that was a pretty big ask, but we looked at it, and in fact, you've got here that one in five of the people in the supervised heroin group, all of their urines were negative. And this is out of 13 random weekly specimens over 3 months. And because I'm a bit of a sort of soft touch when it comes to it, I'd say, well, what if you got most of them clean, but just one, slip up? Then you get nearly 40% in your heroin group are giving predominantly clean urines. And because on a really generous day, I might give you two slip-ups, then you get more than half of that group are giving mostly clean urines. Another influencer. So James Bell took over the clinic. And this takes us into a different era to do with after the trial ended, we secured support from the government that the clinic should be set up, but this coincided with global austerity and funding cuts, so that severely damaged the commitment. But what we've got here is the speed with which those negative urines were occurring, and you've got that by 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, the group in your supervised heroin group, most of those are now giving urine specimens which were negative for street heroin. So whatever changes were occurring were occurring remarkably quickly, and that's been a finding from other groups as well. People wanting to look at cost-benefit analyses, I'm going to skip over this slide because somebody might ask me to explain it, and I'd say, go away and read the paper if you don't immediately understand it. But the take-home message is, if you're in the bottom right quadrant, rather like Louisa was saying earlier, you've got something that is, that is not only giving you benefit, but getting that more cheaply than other methods. So the failure that I've got in the title is to do with, does that then translate into clinical practice? Does government immediately go, I read your paper in The Lancet, and so we're changing global drug policy accordingly. And austerity was the real kiss of death from this point of view. We had government agreement that there would be a dozen clinics set up around the country to look at the rollout of the treatment. Then cuts came in 2010, 2012, and that was reduced to four clinics around the country, became three clinics around the country. But there was that commitment that there should be continuation of the treatment that had been shown to be effective. Our Department of Health put out a call for proposals to set up three clinics. We, amongst with others, had to go through a competitive tendering process, and we were successful in being one of the funded clinics. And for the next 3 years, 3 to 4 years, working with James Bell and others, we then provided this as a treatment within the NHS, so outside the trial setting. And again, this was a second line treatment beyond the first line treatment of methadone or buprenorphine maintenance. And achieved remarkable changes with a group who were otherwise appeared to be untreatable. All sorts of issues came up to do with the costs, and I noticed in Louisa's talk about the £3 billion bill to do with the imprisonment of people with addiction problems. People would worry about the treatment costs of £5,000 or £15,000 for supervised heroin treatment. And you then got to remind them that if you look at drug treatment and testing orders or court treatment, you're looking at £10,000 per annum, and prison in the UK is about £50,000 per annum. So suddenly the treatment is, it needs to be set against that. Finally, after they'd been closed down as part of the cuts when they're put against local services, actually within guidelines about what treatment should be provided, there's a recognition. There's a recognition that there is compelling evidence that it should be provided. So you have a mismatch. You have the guidance drawing attention to the evidence that there is benefit, but at a local level, decisions are made that the patient population doesn't deserve such an expensive treatment. And finally, the government then does issue guidance on if the treatment's been provided to be provided, here's how the government says the treatment should be provided. So concluding with 37 seconds left, here's a group that were previously thought to be untreatable, whatever we mean like that. And yet we find it is possible with highly intensive, expensive treatment that requires a lot of effort from clinicians and from the patients themselves to help people turn things around in their lives. There's now a strong, consistent international evidence base from more than half a dozen randomized trials around the world of that benefit. It's costly to deliver, and rather like intensive care wards or special care baby units, you know, there's no escaping the fact that it's expensive to deliver it, but the benefit is cost effective as well as clinically effective. But what stands in the way is the stigma and the persistent institutional discrimination, not just by society, but within treatment services themselves. So thank you very much.
That was Professor Sir John Strang delivering a keynote address in the 2024 National Drug and Alcohol Research Center's Annual Research Symposium. There were a lot of great speakers at this symposium, start to finish. The poster sessions were tremendously informative. Now, while we still have time, let's hear from one of those speakers. Joanna Zhao is a fourth-year undergraduate at the University of New South Wales. Her presentation was entitled Retention in Opioid Agonist Treatment Following Childbirth and Associated Factors.
So pregnancy has three trimesters, but have you heard of the fourth trimester? It is a phrase used to describe the emotionally and physically challenging period after childbirth. And in this period, women with opioid use disorder are especially vulnerable, as it is clinically recommended that they continue on opioid agonist therapy, which we'll abbreviate to OAT. And as treatment, women are prescribed either methadone or buprenorphine, and this helps to prevent withdrawal and cravings. And retention on OAT reduces high-risk behavior, relapse, overdose and mortality risks, and additionally, it helps promote a stabler home environment and better care adherence. However, we know little about OAT retention in Australia. And that's why we examined the extent to which Australian women were retained on treatment after childbirth and explored a range of factors associated with better retention. And so to conduct this, we linked OAT data to records of childbirths between the 1st of January 2004 and the 31st of March 2020. And we included women who received OAT at the time of childbirth. We defined retention as continuous OAT with no break of over 7 days, excluding or modifying this to 37 days for buprenorphine in custody settings since September 2019. And here are our findings. In our final cohort of 3,933 women, or childbirth, sorry, to 2,514 women, we found that retention was substantially high. being 93.3% at 90 days, 84.4% at 180 days, and 78.5% at 365 days after childbirth. And we also examined retention according to a range of factors using generalized linear modeling. And as we can see in the forest plot, at 90 days, we found substantial variation according to the timing of OAT, where compared to women who received OAT before conception, those initiating in the third trimester had lower retention. Women who overdosed in the year before conception until delivery also had substantially lower retention, or higher retention, sorry, compared to their counterparts who didn't. And for other factors such as age group and Indigenous status, maternal morbidity risks, which included mental health or smoking, and birth outcomes or complications, there was moderate variation. And results at 180 days and 365 days showed similar variation patterns. So to conclude, it is very reassuring to see that most women continued on treatment after giving birth. However, our findings do indicate and highlight the importance of more targeted interventions to help engage women in treatment earlier, even before pregnancy, to enhance continuation of treatment in the so-called fourth trimester. Thank you.
That was Joanna Zhao, presenting on the topic of retention in opioid agonist treatment following childbirth and associated factors. I've spoken a lot about my appreciation for live streaming technology, the ability to attend events from all around the world without leaving home. NDARC's webinar series and annual research symposia are great examples of this. So many amazing speakers, so much vital information being made available to the public freely. Definitely check them out.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. I have asked the Congress to provide the legislative authority and the funds to fuel this kind of an offensive. This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with the problems of sources of supply, as well as Americans who may be stationed abroad, wherever they are in the world. It will be government-wide, pulling together the nine different fragmented areas within the government in which this problem is now being handled. And it will be nationwide in terms of a new educational program that we trust will result as from the discussions that we have had.
For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.